Welcome to the fourth episode of Discord, where two architects with distinct takes on how to do good architecture come together and criticize each other's works in a constructive manner. This show's premise is based on the epistemic sociocognitive conflict theory, quite a mouthful. It postulates the strong correlation between engaging in constructive criticism around the question and improving one's knowledge of both the topic and the format of the discussion. In other words, openly and frankly discussing each other's works leads to better projects and to a healthier architectural culture. This episode features a discussion between Søren Pilmann from Denmark and Sam Chermayeff, an American architect based in Berlin. I will be the host for this episode. My name is Francesco degli Innocenti, and I'm an editor at Volume magazine in the Netherlands. When Francisco asked me to host this episode, two elements clearly stood out: criticism and good architecture. So let's start talking about the second to see what I think about the first. Follow me on this mini journey of around 3 minutes. We're going to start with Filarete. You remember Filarete from history classes, the Florentine architecture theorist of the 15th century? He once wrote that to give birth to good architecture, you can not only have the architect, the mother. Good architecture also needs the father, the commissioner. Think about the incentives of a commissioner and think about the incentives of an architect. They do not always align. And considering that the commissioner holds the keys to the budget, architects are at a disadvantage. Therefore, any architectural proposal needs to be carried on with a lot of professional credibility. For architects, professional credibility is a fundamental necessity. I consider myself an architectural researcher, but not in an academic sense. My definition of research is making sense of things that, at first glance, do not make sense at all. This is why I study architecture biennials. This is why I study architecture awards. But my last obsession is the perception of the architect. How are we perceived? Are we any good at articulating our value to the world? We're not our best judges. So I asked Paul Kersey. Paul Kersey. Look, don't dig into your memory. He never published any book and you haven't met him in Venice last year. Paul Kersey is the protagonist of Death Wish, an American movie from 1974. He lives in a New York full of criminals, but he's a good guy, socially minded. One day he goes to work, comes back, and they killed his wife and raped his daughter. He goes crazy, gets a gun, shoots one guy, really likes it, starts shooting people. The end. Terrible movie, but incredible success. 4 sequels, all with the same plot. And you see, it's because the plot worked. The character's transformation from beginning to the end was complete, from good guy to lunatic. Now, in 2018, they shoot a remake with Bruce Willis. Same stupid plot, but they only change one thing in it. Paul Kersey is not an architect anymore. He is a surgeon. Whoa. You see, movies must be synthetic. You cannot say the same thing twice. Historically, film was very expensive. And so if the scriptwriters decided to say this character is an architect, it is only because of the scale of values that the profession represented for society. So I tracked down the new scriptwriters and I asked them, are you telling me that 45 years later that architect doesn't represent anymore the good guy, the socially minded? No, he doesn't. And so what do we represent then? What? Look, society doesn't get us and we don't get how society sees us. Think about another movie, The Brutalist. global praise of critics for The Architect, but the architects hated it. This is a dangerous discrepancy. People don't know what we do, and that we even do it well. For 45 years, we've seen the erosion of our professional credibility. But rather than pointing fingers, are we sure that we haven't withdrawn into ourselves? I mean, 50% of what I have to edit for the magazine is, quite frankly, unreadable junk. It uses architectural language for gatekeeping and virtue signaling. So that's my point about criticism. We need much more self-criticism. Otherwise, society will only know us through the distorted lenses of a bad movie. And if you don't believe me, believe Paul Kersey. And now, the Discord.
So, a coin was flipped. I start. You're in Venice right now. One of the things you sent is, in fact, you call it the unbuilt. But meanwhile, I guess it's built as we speak now.
It's still not really built, but it's like it's in progress.
It's in progress.
And we stay like that for the full exhibition period.
But it stays then forever, so to speak. I mean,
yes. Some of it stays forever. Some of it, not forever, of course, but some of it will stay after the exhibition ends, and some of it will be here only in the period with the exhibition.
I mean, it looked like you were making a terrazzo floor, so that's not temporary.
No, that's true. But I only do part of the terrazzo floor as part of this exhibition. But I'm also doing like an excavated earth floor, which is polished, so it looks kind of like terrazzo. But I just use the earth that was underneath the existing slab. So like the overall idea here is just to stage an exhibition with the elements that was present in the pavilion to begin with without adding anything.
Of course,
we add tools and stuff.
Wait, before we get into like the deeper theory of your work or mine, what do you mean you polish the ground?
I think it's important to get like the whole starting point clarified here, that we knew that there were some things that needed to take place with the existing pavilion here in Venice, because it was in quite poor shape. Some places, like in the extension part, which is from the late 50s, the floor was cracking. It was not reinforced and so on. And there was also something with the windows, etc. So we proposed to the owners, like the Minister of Culture and Palaces in Denmark, that we should take care of that and use that as a good opportunity to start a discussion about how we should be better at taking care of our existing buildings, as well as how we should be better at finding new ways to utilize waste. So we thought, like, as a funny experiment and like as a constraint for this overall contribution this year, we thought like, well, let's carry out this full-scale renovation, and we won't have time enough to do it all before the exhibition, so we'll just do some of it. And then none of the waste that we create as part of that construction process will have to leave the pavilion. It will stay inside the pavilion itself, and then we'll find interesting ways on how to utilize this for different purposes.
So starting with Discord, like the question then is, how big of a pain in the ass is that?
It's a huge pain in the ass.
Fucking nightmare.
Yeah, it is. It is. But I think I kind of like the discomfort of bringing me into these situations. It's kind of like it's part of my artistic practice.
No, I get that. But I just and I think it's beautiful, right? Both conceptually and literally. And I'm not letting you off the hook about how you polish earth. But we can come back to that. But just in general, the premise of your practice, you know, carefully reusing things, kind of, let's say, like really advanced ideas about maintenance, right? Which I think is very elegant. The kind of question is, you know, the question is like, is that a good use of time and resources? I mean, just to start being critical. And I don't have a strong feeling about it.
No.
I'm just asking, like, does it make sense for you to spend your time? I mean, okay, in Venice, it's different, right? Of course, in Venice, like, it's totally fine to have to blur the lines between practicality and polemic, right?
Mm.
And you did send another project, so I'm well aware, and I'm totally into Parabasse and other practices that are working in the same way. But you know, the question is like, is it like a Danish-Swiss endeavor, or does it make sense for the rest of us?
Yeah, it does. It definitely makes sense. But I think, like, I totally understand your questions whether it makes sense to spend that much time on it, because it do take a lot of time.
Right, that's...
And like if you have to be on the construction side constantly, and you have to reevaluate all your decisions and look into everything that you create and that you find. But I think the reason why I find this fascinating is because I think there's so much that we can learn And I think we are just getting started to really understand like the leftover and the waste material of a building industry that was created for, let's say, 80 years ago or something like that. So all these buildings that we need to have, find new ways to maintain right now, like the only way we really do that is just by throwing the things out that we don't like or that doesn't work anymore and then build new. And I think there is a huge potential in really diving into this and find new ways to utilize it. So I think right now, yeah, we have to spend a lot of time, but I'm also trying to see how can I spend my time right by inviting the right people on board so that we can learn something from them. So it's not just artistic work of mine, but like in this case, in Venice, for instance, I've invited a lot of researchers that are dealing with how to utilize waste material from construction sites. So they have been part of the exhibition and they have been on field trips here in Venice. So that's part of the research project as well.
I mean, an equally good retort would be like anything good takes a lot of time, just to say. I mean, just like in your other, like in a defend, to like defend your you in another way, messing with any kind of ideological grounding, which is,
yeah,
which is in your case, like industrial processes from, you know, after the war, essentially. Right, like to kind of unpack it in your case literally, but also to unpack it in my case, like more ideologically. Like, wait a minute, did we agree to make kitchens in a line? Do we agree that Rawl is the right like way to make a color system? Like, no, we did not. Right, like the Germans just decided that so the bullets fit in the guns. Right, I mean.
Yeah.
And that's really like the kind of grounding of it is all one thing that we're dealing with, like this kind of modernist mass consumption idea that indeed just takes tremendous effort, whether it's like at your desk or in your case, like carving the floor up. I mean, just to say whatever you do with it to change something takes fuck all. A lot of time.
Yeah, yeah. It does. But I also think like we have been so obsessed trying to find out how to utilize our time in the best or most effective way as possible. And I think in doing so, we also lost a lot of understanding of like all the small potentials that arise during a process. We just, you know, we don't notice them at all because we are just so focused on this end result that we planned ourselves out with. Like we spend years before construction site. Before construction process even begin. And then when it begins, like we have a super efficient plan of how to carry out all of it.
Yeah.
So we are not aware of all these small potentials that arise naturally as part of a quite organic process. We try to like, oh no, now I say we, but I think most people try to like get rid of them as fast as possible because sure. they're obstacles. They want to change your overall vision. But I think this is where I think there's a huge like artistic potential and like potentially a vision that could arise organically through the ongoing construction.
I buy into that. I mean, and then the kind of the flip side of that question is like, what do we do with the extra time with the efficiency that we create?
Mm.
What's more joyful? I assume that it's also fun to sand the floor and it's kind of a pleasure and you get into it. You create meaning in the floor by making the floor, you know, you sort of, I assume, that you yeah. create something out of you know like out of the work that spirit that like kind of spiritual level, let's say, like you imbue it with value for yourself, you know, particularly if it, I know that you're talking about an institutional building there and your other project is that too, but yeah. if you do it in your house it really matters, just like if you make dinner you can make dinner really quickly under the premise that you need to, you know, efficiently ingest nutrients.
Yeah, no, but I think you are, it's on point what you're mentioning here, because it's also, for me, it's really about getting close to things, right? I think that's one of the big difficulties as an architect, because we are so much used to plan the things and then other people like really carrying out the physical work. But I think like there is a huge pleasure, as you mentioned, just like to cook for yourself, like yeah. to really take the time that it takes to do something probably that you're going to enjoy afterwards. And of course, if you engage in that process, in the very process of creating it, you also, I think you get more close to the final result. You can tell the differences between why it was too salty or something else. And you remember when you did it wrong. So you also improve your process. And I think this is also the reason why so many architects continue to build physical models, even though that it takes weeks. And, you know, you can do that instantly with digital tools, but you don't get the same understanding of what you're trying to achieve without really having it in your hand.
And if you don't have it lying around, which is really important.
No,
Exactly. I realize that like half the reason to make models is so that you like that you gets dusty next to you and then you look at it all the time without really thinking about it. And then it gets somehow like you start to think like, is it still good? Like more by its physical proximity. Like we have, I'm surrounded by models now. And it's
but can I ask you a question, Sam? Are you still doing your own models?
Like myself? Not as often as I would like. I make really fast, crappy ones for
Okay.
Yeah. The prettier ones. I mean, now that the projects get bigger, they have a lot of floor plates. So sometimes I show off because I can cut the floor plates out really fast. Because I was pretty good at it at Sana. I was like, Sejima said that I was the best white guy ever.
The best white guy ever. What a compliment.
To say like utterly worthless. Because which is to say they're a small Japanese child in terms of skill. I do like doing it. Wait, to come back to this kind of idea of efficiency and so forth. I mean, another analogy that I was just reading in the newspaper is like an online dating. I know that it's like maybe it's like a big jump, but you know, it turns out that it has it's obviously very efficient, right? It's like a really good way to get laid quickly, right? So like you go on, you know, and like you cut, like let's say you cut the process down to a relatively efficient, you know, set of criteria, yada, yada, yada. And then, but then apparently like it has a lot of other problems that, and I don't know this so much from my own experience, but just the idea, like it turns out to be problematic that we don't have this, that we lose the skill of the, like we lose the practice as like society of like how to like mate in a very, I know it's, because you're talking about architecture and it's like, yeah, but it's not exactly an architectural problem. It's sort of like a general 21st century problem of like efficiency to what end, right? And like,
but I know, I think, inefficiency. Sam, I think, yeah, exactly. And I think what you're mentioning, it is kind of like the same. Because I think what you lose is friction. You lose the friction that is being created by, like, it doesn't matter, like if two people meet, like there is a lot of friction, like you want different things and you have to like kind of like engage with one another to understand where we're going. And by engaging with another person, you also get to know something about yourself as well as you get to know something about that person. I think it's exactly the same when you as a skilled or not skilled worker are dealing with a material. Like you really have to engage with and you have to feel the difficulties, you have to feel the qualities, the properties, the weaknesses, all these kind of things. And you can only understand that if you're really physically engaging with it. And that's the reason why I like to spend so much time on the construction side. And I think that's the reason why you still, even though you don't do it that much, like to build a model now and then, because there is a lot of friction in using a sharp knife and some cardboard.
But in the name of making friction between us, like, don't you want, as I do, to just make, like, to really change the world by actually making, you know, 500 units, by making 1,000 units, by scaling in the in that same kind of modernist way that got us to the problem in the first place.
Yeah, that would be lovely. No, I think I would like to do that, but I think in order to be able to do that, I have to, there's a set of questions that I need to find. Of course, I'll never find answers to them, but like some kind of answers to begin with. So I feel I'm still like in a process right now where I have raised a lot of questions for myself that I would like to find some kind of valuable answers for, which I hopefully will make it easier for me in the future to scale my method up. So I'm thinking a lot about my method. I'm spending a lot of time like continue to developing my own method.
Because I want you to make it work in a way that it doesn't feel like it takes like Danish/Swiss money to pay for your time to make, you know, 5 units, right?
Yeah, exactly.
In the time that it takes you to make five, I can make 500. I don't mean me. I mean me and the rest of the world can make, you know, pour some fucking concrete, get some glass, and call it a day.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more complicated than that, admittedly, but also not.
No, but you're right, because in the end, like, you know, at our office, we talk a lot about resources, but of course, resources can be many things. Time is a resource. Economy is a resource. There's so many things. It's not just materials at all in the end. It's a lot of things. But I feel like right now, architecture finds itself in a very difficult position because, you know, everybody seems to try to investigate or find new ways on how we can move on with architecture. Like some people think that we shouldn't build anything anymore. Some people think like we should just continue as we've always done, and some people think that there are new ways to build or like rebuild or transform the existing. And I kind of like this. I feel it's like an intermezzo in the architectural history right now, that we're trying, we understood like what we did was wrong. And now we're looking for a new way to move forward. And we really haven't found that yet. And it's, I like to engage with that in between situation and just see if we can contribute to develop some methods on how to move forward in a better way.
To that end, who are the experts that you dragged down to Venice to like work with you on things?
So in this case, we did a field trip with a company. So that we went down here and we dug a hole in the floor, did some excavation work just to see like what kind of materials are present. That was just like an overall registration phase. And we teamed up with the Danish Architecture School. There is a institute there called Cultural Transformation Restoration. They're used to do it going on field trips. So we made a collaboration with them. Like the whole semester project was about this pavilion. So they sent 30 students here, measured everything up, did both like handheld manual measurements as well as digital measurements. So we had like a one-to-one copy, digital copy of the building, and then all the field trips figuring out what are the materials, are there any toxic materials, etc. And then based on that knowledge, we invited, for instance, like a soil specialist from Switzerland to come here with us that are used to earth structures because there was a lot of clay in the ground underneath. We invited a postdoc from the Copenhagen University who was dealing with bio-based binders on how to use construction debris and sand and silt and so on and mix it with agar, chitosan, gelatin types of bio-based and like reach the, some of the same compression strength that you normally reach in concrete.
Can you do that? Does it work?
It does work. There's a lot of issues with it. For instance, like gelatin, it melts at certain temperatures, so it's not really fireproof. But it's an ongoing research that he did a PhD on it, and he's now continuing his research. We like to invite him down here to just be part of the team and investigate the things that we found and see how could we use, how could we do something with the knowledge that he had from his PhD and the things that we found on site. And we did the same with some people from Atelier Luma. They worked with alginates, and they could do some of the same things. We collaborate with the people from the Danish Technical University, who's running this institute focusing on how to utilize mostly used construction elements in new builds. And they do so by using a lot of different technologies, such as LIDAR, radar, ultrasonic, pulse velocity, scanning methods, and so on. So we sent them here, and then they scanned the whole pavilion. And we could see where there are rebars, where there are cracks, where there was different things. And then based on that, we could kind of like start to harvest materials in the pavilion for different purposes. So it was a lot of different fields that we activated. And all of them, now they, you know, they spent time here, and they learned something that they could use in the ongoing research, as well as we developed like a set of drawings of the building, which was not present before because that was lost during a flooding from many years ago in an archive here in Venice. I think like lots of our work here has been about just understanding the existing and see how many fields that we could activate as part of that.
And I assume that apropos like it being an interregnum, like it applies to many things, that research. It's not specific per se to the pavilion itself. No. I mean, it's a pretty universal building, actually, now that I think about it.
Yeah, exactly. It is. And again, I think it's just to, you know, in a way to demonstrate a way of thinking that hopefully could be scaled up and other people could learn. But hey, can I ask you, like, now we talked a lot about Venice here, Sam.
Sorry.
Because I was a bit, from one unbuilt, which is half built, to another unbuilt Miami district. Like, was it Miami Design District?
Yeah. Yeah,
because first I thought when I was looking at it, it looked like you said, like what's called like the back end or was the backstage, and it looked like that you were showing the backstage of a building, like the backside of the building. And then I realized it was actually the backstage with lamps and stuff,
yeah,
the stools,
yeah.
But like a backstage, like 4-story high,
yeah.
But like only one level. Can you just explain to me what's going on?
It was a good idea that we had like quite a long time ago, and it's kind of our favorite unbuilt project because we want to build it because it's quite easy to do. In fact, they even paid for half of it, but doesn't matter. We had this commission to do the backside of Christian Dior, like in an alley, but the alley was like later becoming a kind of important passageway from somewhere to somewhere else, right? In like kind of, they call it a design district. I mean, it's just a really fancy shopping district, right? So there's like a Celine store and a Louis Vuitton, yada, 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 all that stuff around. But then there was this like leftover pretty shitty facade. And I think that they wanted us to make a mural, which I don't know how to do because I don't make paintings. And Barbara and I, my partner, don't do that. And it's Miami. And so we were like, all right, what's Miami? What's back? Like, and so we came up with this like quite straightforward thing, which is like, let's make a place for you to do your makeup and like look at yourself and like get, because it's a self-involved, like the entire environment like is a self-involved situation. So it's like, let's lean into that. Let's lean into like people are buying whatever expensive handbag, like then they want to look at themselves. And, you know, Miami is sort of unabashed about that, right? It doesn't have this veneer of respectability that Europe often pretends to have, which in a way like too cool to do that. Like in Miami, people are like completely happy to like constantly adjust their appearance, right? It's like the plastic surgery capital of the world, which I, which I'm fine with, right? I mean, it's not to be confused with like, I want plastic surgery, just that we like the idea of, okay, let's make a celebration of people.
Yeah.
And I guess all of our work is about like figuring out fun and interesting moments of celebration that are often overlooked, right? So it's like the artistic practice is just like yourself, like people. Go do it. You become, right? And so we've actually built like many versions of it, although that's like the most clear one. But makes the idea is to make you kind of get into yourself, which I think is where we're at anyway in the 21st. So part of our thinking is to lean into it. And indeed, it's a backstage for people to access and use. And it had like a phone charger and an ashtray and a stool and a, you know, you could like really enjoy yourself. It was like practical.
But it's also seems like, because now I've been talking a lot about like materials and engaging with materials and so on, but it seems like in your practice, like this, there is an overall theme of like social interaction that you're playing around with in quite humoristic ways.
Yeah. I mean, we lean into the idea that you can do things in public space and that you can do things and that like what's public and what's private. Also within the home, like the tiniest.
Exactly.
You know, like that the kitchens, of course, are no longer other rooms in any of our projects. Like, they're all part of living, right? Like they're all, and they're not, they're also not, apropos your work, like they're not practical in the sense they're not to try to get food made quickly. They work perfectly well for cooking, extremely.
Okay,
well.
But like, what is it like in the first place? Why are you so obsessed with bringing the kitchen into another room than the living room, for instance?
That's a straightforward question. Because just like you're obsessed with cutting the floor up to figure out what it's about and feeling it, it's like you want to feel things. So it doesn't have to be in another room, but it has to be organized in such a way that whatever you do there is something that is like is a celebration of that act. And very often that act is with other people, right? But at first and foremost, it's first of washing a dish or cooking a steak or whatever it is. But secondarily, that celebration is often involving other people, even in like single people's lives, right? You bring people over and so forth. And to try to make cooking or really any activity, we're moving on to bathrooms, but we haven't quite gotten there yet. more connected to whatever it is you're doing. And that's often, I mean, that's people. Everything.
Yeah.
Friction, to go back to your old word, like all friction is people also.
Yes, exactly. No, but I think like I really like the way that you coined with this word, like the celebration of the act. Like there is something about that I like very much. I think for me, it reminds me of some of these, you know, for instance, the American philosopher Thoreau that moved out in the forest, built himself a cabin and to grow his own vegetables and stuff and to build a cabin on his own. You know, just to feel like what it actually takes just to live. Like, it seems like there is something about reducing all things that is not like essentials to your life and like remove them from your life and then engage more with the things that is really essential.
That's part of it. It is indeed. It's like you make choices about what you want to do, right? I mean, it's also about making choices about celebration, like I personally celebrate maybe too many things, right? And I can get lost in my own, I get high on my own supply, meaning I often like make a new stove. Like, so I have like 10 stoves in my apartment, but which is to say like, it's not exactly about reduction. It's more about, to put it in maybe a word that I like better. It's like focus in terms of my own work. Like you shine a light on something and then you can also enjoy it in a different way.
Yeah.
Right? Meaning, like, including building a cabin, including growing a vegetable. I mean, if you think about, I mean, for a long time, I've been very taken by, like, universal basic income, right? Which is this idea, quite a lefty idea, that if we just tax rich people higher, like, you could work a whole lot less in your banal job, and then you have a ton of free time. And then what do you do in that free time? And I think, like, a fair number of people would get drunk all day, which is fine. Right. But then a fair number of people might make like a tomato, but only 10 of them per year that are just outstandingly good tomatoes. And I guess I'm taken by the idea of what people do in their, let's say, free time, because it's really problematic. Like the notion of efficiency, like what do you do with more efficiency? Like either you have a hobby or you just like end up buying more shit on Amazon or like reading more crap on Instagram or whatever. So you have like, it's also a response to valuing your time, like your spare time.
But is it a bit contradictory that you find it fascinating to have more spare time when you really want people to engage with the actual act of living? Because in spare time, what are you going to do then if you're just sitting getting drunk? Or
well, that's what I mean. I mean, that's what I mean. It's like your spare time is the time that you make dinner, right? I mean, that is, I think that like I'm suggesting, among other things, to move that into the column, which modernism didn't, right? Modernism thought that like making dinner was work, right? I mean, like as a premise, the Bauhaus thinks that cooking is work, right?
But I don't see it that way. I don't see a big distinction between working and cooking. For me, it's just like doing things that I find valuable. I also like, you know, of course, for me, like to work is also a way to be able to afford living the place that I live and so on. But I feel like all kind of engagements that I have, both professionally and personally, I try to find like interesting ways to engage with it. Of course, I wouldn't like to have a job where I was doing something that I wasn't pleased with. And I think it's up to each person to find something to do that they are capable of doing and at the same time they are pleased doing. But for me, it's just as valuable to sit and draw a building as it is to cook for my family.
Me too, except I'm much better at drawing a building than cooking it for my family. And that,
but you can learn that. You can learn that.
Yeah, but that distinction means a lot. The distinction of like my skill is the distinction, and your skill too. The value is the same, but the value to everybody else is totally different. That's what makes me move it very much away from the work column for anybody else that I cook dinner. Right. It's not about a larger question. It doesn't have any implication for anyone else, my dinner. Right.
No.
Or put it, maybe a better way to put that is I don't have an ambition when I cook beyond my family. Right. Or friends. And that, I mean, you're carving up the floor as an ambition, in fact, like way beyond that floor. Right. So like that, okay, it's a value and it's there, but part of the story of it is its ramifications with House Europe, with the rules, with the future of architecture. I mean, those are big fucking questions, right? Whereas when you make pasta, fuck it, you know, maybe it's bad even. It's still valuable, right? Whereas like if your floor is bad after a while, it's a problem, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. Can we move into the toilets now? I'm very curious. No, I don't know. What about them? You just said that we haven't got into the toilet yet, and I'm just intrigued about speaking of toilet.
Okay, it starts from this thing which Barbara told me that I'm never allowed to talk about again, which is my partner. But Slavoj Žižek talks about toilets, and he talks about how they're like ideological. The French have the hole in the back. It's the left. You take a shit, it goes down. The Germans have it in the front. You smell it. It's conservative. It's hermeneutic. The British, full of water. You take a shit, it floats. Pragmatic in the middle. So the claim is like, obviously reductive, is that in fact, like, toilets represent ideological things, right? And the kitchen dismantling is also an ideological thing about the machine, so that the oven fits in the corpus, so that you can have Polyform make expensive Italian ones and IKEA make whatever other ones and Siemens, and that just like putting the bullet in the gun, it's all like weird systems that came many generations ago and we didn't even notice. I mean, that's the thing about the bathroom. So you have like ideas about hygiene that's like, where do we get that idea? First of all, it's not like you have tuberculosis like floating around in your bathroom. So like you could probably eat off your bathroom floor if you so desired. I'm not suggesting that. I'm only saying that like you could think about bathrooms in many other ways. But bathrooms in the German-speaking world are about being cleaner.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, sensualizing your body, or as opposed to, like, celebrating who you are, or as opposed to relaxing. I mean, bathrooms are not really about relaxing. They're about cleaning, specifically in... I mean, I think that's true in Danish culture too, more or less.
Yeah, it is.
And but the French, for example, put carpets in their bathrooms, which is, you know, at first glance, pretty gross from a kind of a German perspective. I'm not German, but incidentally, but you know, Americans do all kinds of different things, so it's less clean to, you know, make stereotypes. But the, you know, I like the, just thinking about the carpet. Let's just talk about, like, the carpet in the bathroom suggests prioritizing the feeling underfoot over the cleanliness, like, by a lot, right? And it suggests, like, it suggests a focus on a different aspect of your life, which, again, is ideological, right? Like,
yeah, it
gets
is.
Into, like, a gets into how you see everything. Everything in the world is, like, somehow embodied in that decision. For, you know, French society, there's a kind of slowness. The other one that's really fun is, like, Swiss bathrooms, which are, like, the worst bathrooms and the nicest made bathrooms. Like, if you go and look at the joint between tiles in a, like, a mediocre hotel in Zurich, it's nicer than you could ever get in anywhere in the world. But it's also, like, the most sexless, like, underfucked bathroom you can conceive of, right? So it's, like, a perfect, perfect tile joint. And yet, and yet it makes you, it's like deeply alienating at the same time. And it's so well made that it even, like, it separates you from yourself, from your, like, any story of yourself. It's quite a radical thing. And I guess, so I want to cut to the chase. I really want to get into, like, those questions and, like, get more aggressive about why we've made those decisions.
Okay, but that's okay. This I find very interesting, because I was just about to ask you that, like, all the things that you're mentioning is something that you find fascinating and interesting, but, like, what are you extracting from this? Like, how do you work with this in your practice?
In short, I'm, like, putting carpets in bathrooms and trying to make things messier and trying to feel like, well, what are the edges, and, like, where do you find the joy, right?
Yeah.
And, like, where and, like, how much water can you get everywhere before it's, you know, and to really think that through, right? Like, how much and how much pleasure can you have in the opposite, in the mess, right? Because part of the kitchen thing is, like, if you deconstruct the kitchen, you end up with these crevices that are dirty, right?
Yes, exactly.
But that's an accidental thing that I just say I don't care, rather than, like, but in the bathroom, it's actually something you can take joy in. And the Japanese, for example, have, like, those wooden bathtubs that are, like, half rotten, which are amazing. And that rotten thing, I'm trying to figure out in my practice, make other people, like, get into that.
Yeah.
As a practice.
You have this, like, you know, it's like in most Western countries, like, you're obsessed with, or, like, most people are obsessed with these maintenance-free houses. It's like, you need to have a house that doesn't need any maintenance, but, like, ultimately, it's like, it's a lie. Everything needs maintenance. It's just a question, like, the time period, like, you look into it. But I think this is essential. I think we're just using different sets of words, the senses to describe this. Because for me, I think this was what I tried to describe, not very good, but earlier in our conversation about friction. Like, for instance, if you take this perfect Swiss bathroom with, like, the perfect tiles and a tiny, tiny grout between the tiles, there is no friction. Like, I want to see the unevenness of the burnt edge of the tile and the grout, which is, like, popping out, because it's, like, it's too, like, it has a too low viscosity for that specific purpose. There's something about if everything is getting too streamlined, you're, like, you kind of, like, erase all thresholds and all obstacles. You kind of, like, also erase the materials or architecture's ability to tell a story about itself.
Yeah.
And this is where I start to feel unwelcome. Like, I really like a welcoming space, like a rotten bathtub, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
That's a welcoming space.
And I also, like, I mean, to come back to both of our built projects.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah, we haven't talked about them.
Well, we don't have to talk about them necessarily, but they both, like, put people together in quite a dense way, right? So, like, you have, in your case, meeting rooms where people are walking by the stairs and you can see people, and there's, like, hallways with glass. And so it's not a notion of, it's not disturbance free in terms of people, right?
No.
Apropos, like, grout and people being the same thing. Like, people disturb each other. Like, in our housing projects, you can somehow see your neighbors, right? Mm-hmm. Like, in a lot of situations, which European architecture goes, you know, far out of its way to make, you know, every apartment a kind of castle. Mm-hmm. Such that you don't see anybody. And then, you know, relatedly, as you point, you know, now that the 20th century is sort of concluded, we've got all this privacy individually, we've got all this efficiency, and now we're like looking at our phone to make friends. And it's like, really, why don't we just not make castles and have a little bit of friction between people in our buildings? Like, not, doesn't feel in your project like that it's wildly excessive. It just feels like you can see from one meeting room to another meeting room. You can, like, you have all these interruptions. It's probably loud as fuck in your building. Yeah. I don't know. I'm just guessing. Yeah. I didn't go in there, but it looks like a lot of hard surface. And it's like, but fine, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think it's fine, you know?
I totally agree. But I think, like, for me, it's just, like, you always, like, when you work as an architect, you kind of, like, you compose things, right? You become, like, some kind of a creator putting things together. Like, sometimes it's, like, single elements. It could be materials. It could be all, like, systems and structures. And I love to see when these systems or these structures, they don't really align, when they are, like, overlapping. And then pay attention to this, that they are not fully aligned. Like, and I want to emphasize that or amplify that even more, so you can see, oh, these elements, they definitely not work together. And that's the quality. Like, there's happening something right now that does something differently. And it does so because there are multiple voices, and you need to, all of them has to be able to. It requires that sometimes you can't flatten everything out.
And you don't need to separate everything.
No, exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
Recently with my students, like, I found myself saying, like, try never to put two materials, like, flush to flush.
Yeah, exactly.
And then
that's a good way.
And like, because you're never going to get it to work nicely, right?
No.
And at least not in the way that you imagine, like, looking at my own office's Instagram, where, like, things are lined up pretty nice. And my students were, like, trying to do this flush to flush thing in various points. And I was like, you can't do that. And then they looked at me like, why not? And I was like, well, it won't align. And then, like, some guy said to me, so what? And I was like, fuck it, you're absolutely right. And I actually like changed my mind about it recently.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, okay, yeah, fine, make it fucked up.
Yeah, but because that's like, the thing. Then you also have to accept that.
Yeah,
exactly. You just have to accept that. It's like, because it could also be a good way to even get more light and amplify the flaw and the error even more by trying to align them as good as you can, but you know you will never succeed. In that, and like in that trial, there is a lot of architecture.
Yeah.
That you end up having quite a messy result, but you did your very best. And you knew that beforehand, that it would end like this. And you could have disguised the differences better by not trying to align them. But you deliberately decided to align them because that's the only way to show the difference.
And in your case, that takes advantage of the fact that you have the excuse of, like, it's reused and it was already lying around there somewhere. So, like, you know, you can say, like, wasn't me.
No, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. No.
If you make it out of stainless steel and concrete, you can't really, in our case, not that we're against reuse, if you make it our way at the moment, it's really like, why'd you do that?
I think it's about also give away some kind of control, right? I really like when you just find things and you have to deal with the size and the proportions that you already have. And then you try to put them into a position where they almost work, but they don't really work. And I think that's the problem of working with industrialized products that are being produced on demand, is that you kind of, like, you have too much control of everything. And then you end up being obsessed with, like, millimeters of tolerances, because you can decide that. It's just a question of, like, write it into a piece of paper.
But we're building buildings now in Albania. And the whole question is, like, how do we build in, like, how do we let them in a way fuck up certain details?
Yeah.
And have it still be cool and make sense. This is a very fun endeavor, because we're making like a 44 story building and an 18 story building. And of course we want them to be nicely made, and they do too. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Like, the clients do too, right? Like, everybody wants it. Everybody wants it to be like, everybody wants it to look like it's made in Denmark, right? Right. Even though it's.
Oh, okay. Is that a quality thing? To be made in Denmark.
Well, you know what I mean. It just means really well made, right? Yeah, and yes, things are well made in Denmark. Come on. I mean, too well made. I mean, Denmark's problematic. I mean, Copenhagen, the whole that's like a separate discussion, but like Denmark has like another, like it's too happy. The bicycle thing works too well. The whole.
But you know what, Sam?
It's all too
clean. We are exceptionally happy.
I know, it's happy problematic. But the Finns are exceptionally happy too, but they don't look it.
No.
No, the Finnish are even happier, but they look kind of pissed off just as a facial expression. And that I find it much easier to deal with. I'm really trading in European stereotypes today, but it works. It's entertaining.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
What I was going to say is trying to figure out how to make buildings that can have substandard, like not fancy details is very, very fun. And it changes a lot how we think.
Yeah.
And maybe that works in the reuse thing. I mean, in a way, like those Parabus projects are also kind of cool because they have like huge, like absurd tolerances in those. When they remake that structure, like, because they don't know what it is, you don't really know what it is that you can't really guarantee the re-ground up floor and the gelatin, right? Like, you have to make it like mis-sized in a way, right?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
That's like a knock-on effect of it. You don't know. There's mystery inside reuse, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at.
Exactly. And I think that's the lovely thing about it. That's the interesting. That's the fascinating thing about. And I think that's just about reuse. It's really about just understanding like the metabolic journey of materials in a way. Like, it's too boring to talk about that you harvest the natural raw resource, then you cultivate it and you produce like a building component, then you build with it, and then afterward you throw it out, and then you build with a new material. There is something about understanding that you're dealing with a material that will continue to exist in some form. It's just like, you can always, of course, crush or burn a material, but it will evaporate into something else. Like, it will never disappear. And I like to like see how many stories and narratives can I bring with me from some of the existing components, elements that I work with, and how can they play a crucial role in some of the buildings that I am working with. It's a way of creating, I think it's a way to create richness.
Yeah, I do
because
too.
I think it's become too dull just to work with right off the shelf materials all the time.
You know, I find it easier in design stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Where one of our like fun things is we're working with Noel, and we wanted to make marble stuff. And then we discovered that they throw out like the rest of the Saarinen table. Like day one, they cut it and they throw it out. And so now we're making plates out of it. That's like our one big reuse project. But they make so many that in every color that you can just like order, you just like free marble this, you know, 50 round for as far as the eye can see, you can have free marble already at the place where they cut the marble in circles. And it was like, really? And they were like, yeah, you can have it. And I was like, okay. So,
That's crazy.
It's a lucky situation. I mean, we don't have, so instead of looking at it on the place, I guess, right? We're like finding it in the world and then being like, well, what can we do with it? Which so far is working pretty, maybe it's working.
But I think this is also, it also comes back to like a hierarchy that we are creating on our own. Like, we have decided what is valuable, what is not valuable. And I think it's worth questioning this way of defining what is valuable and what is not valuable. For instance, like in the project that we, like that I sent you, the build project, 4x29, like we gathered all wooden waste material in a huge pile from the construction process, you know, because we were tearing down like lightweight walls where they had like wooden profiles in the center. We also had some places in the building where there were parquet floor in ash and there was some plywood boards, etc. Then we shipped it all to local factory in Denmark, where we shredded it all up into smaller fibers and produced a ton of new particle boards. And then we did all the furniture for the building in particle boards made out of waste material from the construction site. And I think that was super interesting also, because then we could start to talk about like, what is the coarsity, or like the denseness of the particle board? And like, suddenly you could start to see like colored patterns, which are from the old doors and so on in the former building. So you see like a purple color and you see like a blue color because they were painted in vivid colors all around. And you kind of like tell the story, you kind of like see, okay, so they came from the building itself. Like, they still, like, they are small, they are present. And I like to work with materials in that way also, because it's really like, so people find these furnitures quite beautiful, but it's literally just waste that they are produced of. But not waste from everywhere. It's a way
there.
Of,
yeah.
it's from there. It's something that has a certain presence that was that they were present already. So I think it's crucial if you want to tell the full story of the building. They shouldn't be discarded. They should be used in some way.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, I think it's fun. I mean, I understand wanting to do that. You know, I mean, the question is like, does it just require endless money, which it does?
No, no, it doesn't. It doesn't. No, it didn't. Well, it's actually, and I am, I didn't share any like economy as part of this chat, but it was quite decent.
Okay.
It was way lower cost than if you compare it to all other kind of cultural buildings in the greater Copenhagen area.
No, that's fair. That's true. Yeah, fair enough.
So,
and I really like, and I'm interested in talking about that building. Like, I like the kind of way you deal with the joints and like how you can, I mean, as we talked earlier, like how you connect disparate things that weren't meant to be connected in that same way, right? Like how you suddenly angle that slab and then you have that weird steel junction, like kind of joist hanger that is enormous. And I mean, I think like the, all of that kind of work, I mean, I hope that we as architects like stay flexible about it and advance it for a very long time, as opposed to suddenly say like, okay, this is now the joint between like two old concrete beams, which is kind of that particular thing is like very unresolved, right? Like, how do you join two old pieces of concrete in a useful way? There's a lot of ways to do it now, and nobody agrees, and I like that. I mean, it's fun. It's good to work on something that's unresolved.
Yeah, definitely. Because it also, it offers you more like openness. So like you can decide on your own how to do it because you're not being informed already on how you should do it. And I think the biggest strength of starting, at least I found in my own office just after school. So I've never been on a bigger office. So I don't know how to draw a building in the normal way. Kind of like defined that on my own. I don't think that's a good way to develop your own methods. Like you're completely, it's a blank sheet of paper.
Yeah.
Just do whatever you want.
I used to work at Sana for 6 years and it doesn't do me any good when drawing a building, just for the record. I mean, it was very useful.
I'm happy
it
to
was
that.
Very useful in other ways, but
yeah, yeah, but no, I could imagine.
A building, even though I drew a lot of buildings, I mean, no, in fact, I have to give up on a lot of, I mean, I have to unlearn a lot of things from Sejima.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say like, well, listen, I'm not a star architect. That doesn't exist anymore. It's not about making everything under the sun as thin as humanly possible. I have to ask myself when I want it to be thin. You know, I really have to be like, do I care? Because naturally we draw everything as if we're Sana, but it's a house in Albania, so it's not Sana. So, all right. I think we unfortunately don't disagree about very much. Sorry. We'll be right back.